It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer-Kent. Overdoses are rising both statewide and in the United States, but new research suggests that focusing on harm reduction and increasing treatment options can both be crucial strategies in fighting the overdose epidemic. Join in this discussion on what can be done, especially in rural Wisconsin, where treatment options are scarce. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Randy Brown is a professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW Hospital. He is an author of a recent study looking at the relationship between methamphetamine and opioid use with non-fatal drug overdoses. Dr. Brown, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
The study found non-fatal overdoses are more common for people using both methamphetamine and opioids than opioids alone. Why is that happening?
That seems to be primarily driven by the fact that fentanyl is also getting into the supply of other drugs like methamphetamine. And so when you read about overdoses in this study, those are primarily due to overdosing on that opioid that's present in the methamphetamine supply.
Can you explain a little bit about why fentanyl is so deadly and why this is having such a big impact?
Absolutely. It's been an increasing scourge over the last five-ish years, and it's a highly potent opioid, roughly 100 plus times that of morphine. An amount the size of two small granules is enough to cause an overdose. And the fact that it's present in so many other drugs besides heroin is really, creating a problem. Besides things being marketed as heroin or methamphetamine that have that product in it, there are also counterfeit tablets out there, pills that are made to look like a prescription medication, such as morphine or Percocet or Xanax. And those counterfeit tablets also are increasingly containing fentanyl or substances much like fentanyl.
When people are buying those tablets, those counterfeit medications, do they know what's in it necessarily?
Not necessarily, no.
That's interesting. Why are people using meth and opioids together? And here's my thinking on this. They're two very different drugs. So if you're using meth, it's one kind of feeling that they get. And something like heroin is a completely different feeling that they get. Why both?
Good question. And I think, we have some to learn on that front. And so what I say here comes from, speaking with patients and some, research where people have been interviewed. And one is that there's a perception that methamphetamine is safer being a stimulant. There was a perception, particularly before fentanyl started infiltrating the supply, that, well, if I use methamphetamine, I'm less likely to die due to an overdose. Mm. So an increasingly common pattern of use, particularly in our rural areas, is this movement back and forth between methamphetamine and opioid use. That being part of the reason, also perhaps part of the reason, is in an effort to avoid becoming physically dependent on the opioid, which is a really difficult situation to come out of because of the withdrawal syndrome. Coming off of opioids is really, really uncomfortable and difficult to get through. That's part of it. And then also, of course, is just the fact that the methamphetamine supply nationally has just grown so much within the last 10 years. In years past, when methamphetamine was much more common on the West Coast and some pockets of the Midwest, the manufacture was primarily local. Where now with the current methamphetamine trade, it's coming from south of the border from large labs there and a much larger supply.
I was going to ask you that, where things are coming from, and it sounds like there was a shift there. We're talking about the relationship between meth and opioids. Dr. Randy Brown is a consulting physician in addictive medicine and director of the UW Addiction Medicine Fellowship. Randy, the research says methamphetamine use has been endemic in the Western U.S. for decades, and more recent data suggests it has spread to other regions. So when did methamphetamine use begin to really show an uptick here in Wisconsin?
Oh, we really started seeing a pretty hyperbolic rise just within the last 5 years, where reports, and this comes from law enforcement reports around methamphetamine involvement, and those rose nearly 500% just over the last 5 years. So it's really been a fairly recent time frame that our state, and then places that historically hadn't seen it very much, like New England, have really started seeing it more and more.
How does it spread from one region to the next? It feels like a wave that goes across the country.
Yeah, you know, and again, with the much larger supply that's coming from much larger labs, is, you know, for the most part, kind of taking, you know, typical sort of conduits, you know, your interstates and things along those lines. And, you know, another place where, you know, I think we've got a bit to learn so far as how that goes, but it's less common these days, again, for it to be getting produced and distributed locally. That still happens, but it's the bulk of the supply is coming from these larger organizations.
The research studied participants from January 2018 to March 2020. This was before COVID-19 spread widely in the U.S. How is the pandemic affecting the rate of meth and opioid use when you look at it now?
Well, overdoses have been continuing to rise. In fact, in 1 year over the pandemic, we topped 100,000 overdose deaths. And so it didn't create a huge amount of problem with drug supply and access to it. But what it did create was a situation where accessing treatment was more difficult. Accessing harm reduction services and education around overdose prevention was more difficult. People were more likely to be using alone, which is a particular risk for overdose when there isn't someone else there that can recognize that and intervene.
You talked about harm reduction services. What specifically are you talking about?
So there are a variety of services that different organizations can provide to reduce the likelihood of harm coming from drug use, be it injecting or smoking. But I think most people most commonly think about harm reduction services targeting injection substance use, where organizations may distribute clean syringes and clean supplies for drug preparation. They'll educate people around the use of those supplies and deliver that messaging, you know, new works, clean works every time to prevent infectious disease spread. They'll also engage in education around overdose prevention. And so teach people who use about how to recognize an overdose. Again, don't use alone, keep on hand overdose reversal agent, naloxone, commonly known as Narcan, which is a brand name. And so they do all those kinds of things to help people who are using drugs maintain their health.
When we talk about those harm reduction strategies, there are people, critics, who say that when we promote those kinds of strategies, we're just promoting drug use. What would you say to those critics?
You know, I mean, I can see how folks might feel that way intuitively. However, the literature bears out that where these programs are present, we don't see increases in drug use, and we see actually some very positive outcomes associated with the presence of these organizations, including reductions in public use and public overdose. These are organizations that are also helpful in connecting people who use to treatment. when they're ready to go that route. So while, yes, that is a position that's out there, and I think to some may seem intuitive, it actually doesn't seem to pan out that way in reality.
Randy Brown is a professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW Hospital. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. We return now to our discussion on methamphetamine and opioid use and the increase in the number of overdoses reported both statewide and elsewhere. Join in on what can be done to combat this pervasive issue from a public health perspective. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Randy Brown is a professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW Hospital. Randy, you say early response systems need to track non-fatal overdoses to reduce overdose deaths. What monitoring should happen?
Good question. So I think the primary idea behind that is gaining a better understanding of what substances are creating health issues of importance in our communities. And so, testing of substances themselves, getting data around substances involved in overdoses when people report can give us a better sense of the kinds of services that need to be present in those communities to prevent further future harms related.
Opioid clinics sometimes opt to quit Suboxone treatment if a patient is found to be using meth. What kind of effect does that have for the people who use both?
Boy, great question. And, I think the field is coming to recognize some of the challenges with that thinking. That certainly is something that's still common. However, I think there's getting to be more a consciousness around those really being separate issues that need to be clinically managed in different sorts of ways. So for example, if I'm following a patient in my clinic and they're taking a buprenorphine preparation like Suboxone, and they're taking it as prescribed, and I'm following them for their other use, and their, for example, urine testing is negative for opioids but is positive for methamphetamine, and they're taking their buprenorphine, that's a piece of data that indicates to me that their opioid use disorder or addiction is being managed effectively, but that there may be an issue with methamphetamine and that needs to be dealt with in a different way. That said, ongoing use of methamphetamine may also make it more challenging for an individual to follow through with some of the requirements of a specialist program, like an opioid treatment program, where then if they're not, attending to their counseling visits, they're not reporting for their dosing, can lead to a situation where they may be, this is referred to administratively, discharged for reasons like that. My hope would be that, in a setting of adherence and some degree of methamphetamine use, those administrative discharges would be, getting to be less common for reasons I described.
We're talking about the relationship between methamphetamine and opioids in non-fatal overdoses with Dr. Randy Brown, director of UW's Center for Addictive Disorders. I have to wonder, are we figuring out what works? It sounds like treating opioid addiction is so difficult. What do we know now that we didn't know 5 years ago?
So first, treating opioid use disorders or opioid addiction, we can be quite successful with the medications that are available. We know that those save lives, particularly methadone and buprenorphine preparations. And so, you know, we're in a good spot so far as that and behavioral treatment. However, you know, to the point of the study we're talking about, a lot of times that's not accessible for our rural residents, and that's a really big, you know, part of the problem. I mean, the opioid treatment programs that you alluded to tend to be more concentrated in more populated areas. And so our rural residents most often won't have ready access to that. And so we really need to lean on sort of more accessible and general healthcare providers, such as general psychiatrists and primary care providers, family medicine and internal medicine, to gain some familiarity with that treatment. We're a little bit further behind when it comes to treating methamphetamine use disorder or methamphetamine addiction, because there aren't currently any FDA-approved medications that effectively help folks move toward recovery from a methamphetamine use disorder. There are a number of medications with approvals, you know, for other diagnoses that have had some impact, but it hasn't been nearly as dramatic as it has been for medications for opioid use disorder. And methamphetamine use disorder also typically will require fairly prolonged periods of counseling to move someone toward more sustained remission or recovery, which again is a really difficult thing to access and keep people going to that are living in rural areas and may have to travel some distance to get to a program like that.
We talked a little bit earlier about reversal drugs, naloxone, which most people recognize as Narcan. That's kind of the common, you know, the common name for it. I'm curious about your take on this. In Waukesha County, people can now get Narcan through a grant-funded vending machine. What are your thoughts on that approach? Do you think it's a model for other communities to follow?
Absolutely. And amen. Yes. Mm-hmm. I feel like naloxone really ought to have the sort of presence that, say, automated external defibrillators do for heart attack or myocardial infarction. Those should just be, you know, out there, you know, and widely available so that when an overdose situation is recognized, a bystander can intervene efficiently. Because in that setting, seconds truly do count when it comes to providing that rescue and preventing mortality or, you know, other devastating consequences.
How effective is Narcan?
Well, it's very effective. I mean, it sort of goes to the same receptor that heroin or fentanyl does and kicks it off of there. The challenge these days, again, is fentanyl's sheer potency. And so I'd encourage listeners to educate themselves also on overdose recognition and reversal you know, see about Narcan as well. But with that potency, we're frequently seeing that more than one dose of Narcan may need to be administered. And that some care and follow-up may be required. So having more than one on hand and being sure to call emergency services are important aspects of addressing overdose.
In the 60 seconds we have left, I want to ask you for final thoughts. How can healthcare professionals be better prepared to treat people addicted to opioids and methamphetamine? What can they do to improve?
Well, you know, I think, you know, an issue that we hear frequently from patients is that sometimes, you know, very often there's a lot of stigma attached to substance use, and just encourage healthcare providers to approach folks that are dealing with these issues with compassion. You know, even if it's someone that's reported repeatedly for health services related to their substance use, because we know that on average, someone with a use disorder will be struggling with it for close to 10 years before they access treatment, and they may require those you know, repeated contacts to get connected and to make those decisions to follow through. So I just encourage folks to approach each of those visits with compassion and an open mind.
Thank you, Randy. Randy, thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Randy Brown, a professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW Hospital. Up ahead, we speak with two Wisconsin experts about homeschooling. Join in, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. News Update is next on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer Kent. Unlike public school enrollment that saw historic declines during the COVID-19 pandemic, homeschooling has seen a dramatic surge, with numbers increasing by 47% from the 2019-2020 school year to the next. Parents cite a variety of reasons for choosing to homeschool their children, from concerns over the quality of their local public education system to ensuring their personal and religious beliefs are reflected in curriculum choices. But how does homeschooling work, and what rules are in place to ensure that students get the best education possible? Join in with your questions about homeschooling in Wisconsin. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jody Bunton is board president of the Wisconsin Homeschooling Parents Association. Jody, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, and thank you for having us.
Rebecca All, a board member of the Wisconsin Homeschooling Parents Association as well. Rebecca, welcome to you too.
Thank you. Good morning.
Jody, last year public school enrollment dropped statewide by nearly 3%, 25,000 students roughly. The Wisconsin Policy Forum said the decline in enrollment was mostly due to parents opting to teach their children from home. So that happened. But how do this year's homeschooling numbers compare to previous years? Are we seeing this drop off, or is this maintained?
Actually, it's a little too soon to tell. Homeschooling numbers did drop by about 2,500. But we are still above historic levels. In the two decades up to the pandemic, homeschooling numbers ran about 2% of the total student population. Last year, it was at 3.25%, and this year we're at 3%. We will need to see a few more years of data to see if we are going to be returning to that historic 2% level, or maybe we're setting a new level at about 3%. But that remains to be seen.
Rebecca, the Wisconsin Policy Forum says COVID-19 concerns kind of the motivator behind many of the guardians who opted for homeschooling last year. Is that still what you're hearing from your members?
Jody just said it's kind of hard to tell at this point. So we always have a fluctuating group of new members in the fall, and parents tend to try things and they may stay, they may go. So we really can't say yet whether COVID's going to be a continuing driving factor. I will say for people who've never homeschooled before, COVID did open the door in their mind a little more for some of those parents. But again, that's a wait and see kind of proposition.
So if the pandemic kind of opened the door, Jody, what other reasons do parents choose to teach children at home? What do you hear from the people who do that?
The reasons are really wide ranging. You know, some people are feeling that their school is not doing enough for their child. We've seen quite an increase of parents with children of special needs homeschooling their children because their child, they don't feel like their IEP is being fulfilled properly. So they homeschool. People do it just for the more of the flexibility that they can be on their own schedule. Mm-hmm. There's just such a wide variety of reasons why people homeschool.
We're talking about homeschooling children with Jody Bunton and Rebecca Aull, the board president and board member of the Wisconsin Homeschooling Parents Association. Let's talk a little bit about how the mechanics of this work. Rebecca, what kind of costs do families incur for teaching children at home? What can they expect?
So parents who choose to homeschool under Wisconsin law take full legal responsibility for their child's program of education. So there is no public money attached to homeschooling. So you are on your own financially for that. Fortunately, homeschooling has a very frugal cultural tradition, I would say. Homeschooling can be done on a shoestring budget. It can be done as extravagantly as you want to. That's the kind of flexibility that we have as parents. So parents can expect to access tons of free public programming here in the state of Wisconsin. We have outstanding public libraries. We have an outstanding UW system throughout the state that offers tons of programming and interesting things to do. We have great museums. So parents can access a lot of free and low-cost activities and enrichment. And then as far as curriculum materials, homeschooling materials, that is entirely up to the individual families, and those costs can vary widely.
Rebecca, a recent bill in the state legislature would have required school districts to allow homeschooled children to participate in district athletics programs. The bill passed the assembly along party lines but never reached a vote in the Senate. What do you think about that? Should lawmakers revive that bill next year?
I do not think that they should pursue that. Jody, do you have a finger on the pulse of this particular bill? I'm not familiar with this.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with it either. I know that in 2015, in the biennial budget, there was a provision added for homeschoolers to be able to participate in public school sports, and that did pass.
Okay. Jody.
And we did oppose it at that point.
Do you think, Jody, that public schools should receive more funding to provide resources for unenrolled students?
That's not really our wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the public funding is going to be done through the legislature. And, you know, our stance all along is that homeschoolers should not receive public monies.
Okay. Rebecca, I'm curious about how sports work, though, for kids that are homeschooled. Are there some opportunities for them to get involved in sports? What do you suggest for parents who are thinking, this might work for me, but I want to make sure that my child can play baseball or play football?
Absolutely. So my personal philosophy with homeschooling is if you want something to happen, go make it happen. So for my homeschool community, which I'm close to the Madison area personally, we have had lots of parents organizing lots of athletic activities and opportunities for our kids. There are lots of recreational activities through our local recreational centers, parks departments, and school programs that offer opportunities that are not attached to enrollment in the school. So there's plenty of great ways to do that. So it can be a parent being motivated to go out and organize something themselves, as simple as a, you know, pick up soccer game on Saturday morning, to finding their kid a sports league that they can join through their homeschool organization or on their own. So there's lots of opportunities. It's really about parents feeling empowered and using the best information they can find to go out and make it happen for their own kids.
Rebecca, you sit on your organization's legislative watch committee. How could state lawmakers mm-hmm. better support parents homeschooling their kids? What do you think would be a wish list if you would?
Oh, I love this question so much. So the first thing is to be informed about our homeschooling law. So Jody also sits on this committee. She and I co-chair the committee. And we work very hard to make sure that WHPA provides accurate and up-to-date legal information about homeschooling in Wisconsin. We do provide our newsletter to every legislative office in the state of Wisconsin every time it comes out. And we do offer the opportunity to ask any questions to WHPA, you know, free of charge, regardless of membership, to anyone. And we encourage legislators to use that opportunity should they have questions about homeschooling law. As Jody mentioned, we're only about 3% of students in the whole state. So this is not an area of expertise for a lot of legislators. And so we're here to provide that accurate information to them.
Jody, I want to ask you, what do you wish that more lawmakers understood about homeschooling?
I think it would be really helpful if they understood more of the philosophies behind homeschooling and why we do what we do. That, you know, because as Rebecca said, at the beginning of every legislative session, we send a message out to our members asking them to respectfully contact their legislators and ask them to do nothing regarding our law. You know, it's such an odd request to make for, mm-hmm. you know, to call your legislator and say, please do nothing with our homeschool law.
Right.
Because we do have such a great law and it's worked really well for homeschooling families.
And
so if legislators could better understand, you know, why we do what we do and learn more about our law and maybe some of the whys behind why our law was put in place, that would be helpful.
Jody, are there some misconceptions out there, do you think?
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people believe that homeschooling, you just replicate the, you know, traditional school environment in your home, mm-hmm. and that's not the case. And I think that's, you know, one of the biggest places where misconceptions start happening.
Rebecca, I want to ask your thoughts on that. What are some misconceptions? You know, she was talking about that this isn't like going to school at home. So what do you
right.
think? Yeah. What would you like to clear up about what people might think?
So I think that there is a common misconception that the school, public schools and homeschooling are somehow related. And under our Wisconsin law, that is not true. That may be true in other states. So again, there is no federal homeschooling law. All 50 states and all United States territories have their own way of regulating homeschooling under their law. So here in Wisconsin, it is a direct relationship between the parents and the state. And so parents are in complete control of their child's educational program, and they agree when they sign their report that their child is enrolled in homeschooling with the state once a year. They are agreeing and affirming that they are going to follow our law, which requires them to provide a certain specific number of hours of education each year and to cover certain areas of study each year. So the control of a homeschool is entirely within the parent or guardian's jurisdiction. So I think people have a confusion that there is still some kind of a relationship between homeschooling parents and their public school district when there's not. And it would help a lot to clear that up. And I think, like Jody was saying, homeschooling philosophies, homeschooling styles are very diverse in the state of Wisconsin. So what is true for one family and how they choose to homeschool is not necessarily true for another. And so we are a very diverse group, and people can choose to exercise their right in a wide variety of ways.
Rebecca All is a board member of the Wisconsin Homeschooling Parents Association. Jody Bunton is board president of the Wisconsin Homeschooling Parents Association. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer-Kent, continuing our discussion on homeschooling in Wisconsin. Join in on what is required of parents, how students build social skills, and even when learning in a home environment, and what the future holds. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jody Bunton is board president of the Wisconsin Homeschooling Parents Association, and Rebecca All is a board member of the Wisconsin Homeschooling Parents Association. We go to the phone now. We have Terry from Milwaukee with us. Terry, hello. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. I was hoping the guest could comment on the Wisconsin public school system's use of Carnegie credits. When parents enroll their children in homeschool courses, I think it's important that they investigate whether or not the homeschool program provides Carnegie credits for the courses, so that if the children transfer back into a public school system, the courses they've already taken through homeschooling will be readily accepted by the public school system.
Okay. Thank you, Terry. Jody, do you want to field that question? What about those courses?
I'm not familiar with the Carnegie courses or credits. Generally, what happens when, you know, if a family homeschools and then decides to transfer back into a public school, the public school district does have a written policy on what is required. And so then the parent can advocate for themselves and their child to work with the school to, you know, figure out how to best transfer things back in.
Thank you. And now we have Mitch with us as well. Mitch is also calling from Milwaukee. Hello, Mitch. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my questions.
Sure.
I have two basic questions.
Mm-hmm.
One, this is always a touchy subject, is politics. It seems to come a little bit into bearing in homeschooling. And the second is, I'm a man of the arts. I with all the homeschooling groups I know of in the Milwaukee and Madison area where I'm from, I think kids don't get the industrial arts, chorus. They get chorus, I hear sometimes, band, etc. Large. I'm not talking about lessons. I'm talking about large band and musical activities and theater.
Sure. Those are great questions. Thank you, Mitch. Rebecca, what about the politics of homeschooling? What does politics have to do with it?
Oh, that's such a great question. You know, WHPA is historically apolitical. And the reason for that is we have homeschoolers that are of all political interests and just all across the spectrum who are members and also people who are interested in homeschooling. So we are here to empower people to exercise their right under our current law and to protect our current law. So we have done a really great job of maintaining an apolitical stance over the years. So I'm not quite sure what the caller wanted out of that question, but I hope that answers your question. We are here for you, whatever your political interest is, and our only political interest, if you want to call it that, is maintaining our law as it is.
Jody, I'd like to ask you to address the second part of his question, which is about opportunities for the arts. And he's specifically talking about things like band, marching band, choir, those kinds of things. What opportunities might there be for homeschooled children interested in these areas?
Homeschool families do have their children taking music lessons. You know, they take piano or various band instruments. I know there are opportunities for community band groups, you know, depending on what community you're in and what they offer. And I know through the Wisconsin's law, that there's a law also that allows students to take up to 2 public school classes per semester. And so, a number of students will participate in band or orchestra at their local school.
Okay, so they can take them at the local schools, or are there partnerships with, like, perhaps, like here in Wausau, there is a Wausau Conservatory of Music. Are those kinds of organizations, do they partner with you
as
well?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
Thank you for answering that. We're talking about homeschooling children with Jody Bunton and Rebecca All, board president and board member of the Wisconsin Homeschooling Parents Association. Sue is with us on the phone. Sue from New Berlin, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
A question that I have, I've known some absolutely wonderful homeschooling families that I just have the utmost respect for. And I've also run into some families who kind of don't embrace the concept the way that we would hope that people do. And kids kind of get short-sighted, I guess, a little bit, or shortchanged a little bit. Is there any kind of, I hate to use the word regulation, but any kind of way where homeschooling families are kind of monitored to make sure that they're doing the things that are in the kids' best interest?
I think that's a great question. Thank you, Sue. Rebecca, what do you say to that? What kinds of rules are in place to ensure that kids are getting that quality education, that that there are some kind of rules being followed?
Right. That is a great question, and a lot of people have that question. So the short answer is no, there is not. And the reason for that is we do not have compulsory education laws in the state of Wisconsin. So public school, private school, tribal school, and homeschool students are on the same legal footing in that regard. There is no guarantee of an education, and there is no guarantee that educational organization is meeting any specific requirements. What we have in the state of Wisconsin is compulsory attendance law. So to say that there are families who are doing this great job educating their children and doing all the things that you as an outsider looking in on their family wish they were doing is true of both public school families, private school families, tribal school families, and homeschool families. And there are also those families that are maybe not doing it the way that you wish that they were. But under the law, that is true for all of those four legal types of schools. For homeschool parents, what we do is we sign a legal document with the state each year that affirms that we are following the law, meeting those required hours of attendance, and providing the required hours of instruction. So there's no guarantee that anyone in the state of Wisconsin gets a particular kind of education. And what we believe at WHPA is that homeschooling parents are empowered to provide an education to their children in the way that best suits their beliefs and their desires for their own family. I hope that answers the caller's question.
Thank you. And Rebecca, how can guardians ensure that children build social skills? That's one of the questions I hear a lot about. How can kids build those social skills when they're at home?
So that's a question that we hear a lot, and it's also one that we often chuckle about because we feel like as homeschoolers, we don't face a lot of the social skill challenges that school children do. You know, that's my opinion. So my children are out in the world all of the time, interacting with people of all different ages and doing all different kinds of living all different kinds of lives. So how can parents empower their children to build those social skills? Jody had talked about partnerships with local organizations. I've talked about all the kinds of free and low-cost activities that parents can be involved with. So for example, just personally, my family, we were at a lot of those library story times. That was a great place to meet people and have those first friendships with other kids, especially at the young ages. And parents can, again, if you want it to happen for your kids, go out and make it happen. So across Wisconsin, there are a lot of hardworking homeschooling parents who are creating these great social opportunities for their kids, whether it is a gaming club or a sports activity or a theater group. They're helping their kids make it happen. And these kids are out there in the world interacting and building what I feel are really positive social skills that are not constrained by the expectations of an institutional school.
I want to thank you both for joining us today and sharing all this information about homeschooling. Very much appreciated. Jody Bunton is board president of the Wisconsin Homeschooling Parents Association. Rebecca Aul is a board member of the Wisconsin Homeschooling Parents Association. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.